Wednesday, May 4th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Thanks for joining us. Coming up, Donald Trump wins the Republican primary in Indiana as his leading opponent for the nomination, Senator Ted Cruz, drops out of the race.
Together, we left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got.
The last remaining prisoner jailed for supporting the 1989 Tiananmen Square protests is scheduled to be released this fall in China, and the Broadway musical Hamilton receives a record 16 nominations for Tony Awards. It's all ahead. Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump easily won the Indiana primary in a landslide. Meanwhile, Texas Senator Ted Cruz has dropped out of the presidential contest after the big loss Tuesday.
Together, we left it all on the field in Indiana. We gave it everything we've got. But the voters chose another path. And so, with a heavy heart, but with boundless optimism for the long-term future of our nation, we are suspending our campaign.
Trump hailed his victory in Indiana and criticized his presumptive Democratic opponent.
We're going after Hillary Clinton. She will not. She will not be a great president. She will not be a good president. She will be a poor president. She doesn't understand trade. Her husband signed, perhaps in the history of the world, the single worst trade deal ever done. It's called NAFTA.
However, Ohio Governor John Kasich vowed to stay in the race for the Republican nomination. On the Democratic side, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders defeated Clinton in Indiana. I'm joined by VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, Trump said earlier Tuesday if he won Indiana, the Republican race is over. Well, that's what's happened?
Well, that's basically what's happened, and it's happened because of help from his chief rival, Ted Cruz, who has officially suspended his campaign. Cruz does not see a path forward. I must say it comes after a very interesting day in the primary race. Earlier on, Cruz let loose with a broadside at Donald Trump, calling him amoral, calling him a serial philanderer, calling him a pathological liar. It was sort of like the death gasp, I guess, of the Cruz campaign. Cruz was supposed to do well in Indiana some weeks ago. It was a real sort of firewall for his campaign. And I think it became clear that when Trump romped to such an easy victory, that Cruz saw the handwriting on the wall. There was just no way that Cruz could stay in. Now, here's the question. There are still Trump forces out there at work. What do they do? I don't know. Let's see what happens in the coming days to see what they have to say about Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee.
Now, there is one Republican candidate remaining, last man standing, except for Trump, which is Ohio Governor John Kasich. But he's only won one primary, which is his home state of Ohio.
Right. And he is really not showing any signs of catching on with voters. So Kasich will have to take a hard look at what he wants to do in the coming weeks. I mean, there are more primaries coming, including California on June 7th. But right now, if Trump continues going the way he's going, he's very likely to get the 1,237 delegates he needs ahead of the convention in July in Cleveland to claim the nomination. So the only reason Kasich has been staying in the race is because he said he wants a contested Republican convention where he could, you know, compete with Trump for the support of delegates. But that scenario is looking less and less likely after Indiana.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders is projected to defeat former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton in Indiana. What does this show? Because it seems as though even though Clinton has the largest amount of delegates, Sanders is still, he's still in there, and he keeps defeating her in a number of these primaries.
Absolutely right. He's able to raise money. He's able to you know, spread the enthusiasm of his campaign from state to state. He has a lot of support among younger people, among progressives, even among a number of independents that he's drawn into primaries in states like Indiana, where they allow people beyond Democrats to vote. Sanders is not going away. I think this is a bit of a problem for the Clinton campaign. Don't forget, though, she's more than 90% of the way to the number she needs to claim the Democratic nomination. The real firewall for Hillary Clinton that shows no signs of going away are the so-called superdelegates that are party officials, elected office holders in Congress and around the country, Democratic leaders. They're staying with her. So right now, it's kind of an annoyance to have Sanders keep winning, but the Democrats are going to want to look strong, especially against someone like Trump, who's unpredictable and a political newcomer. So at some point, Sanders and Clinton are going to have to figure out how they go here. But based on this victory by Sanders, he's going to keep going right through June 7th when California and other states vote, and he could continue to do well. But it's not likely mathematically he'll be able to catch her.
All right. Well, thanks very much, Jim. That's VOA national correspondent Jim Malone. Among the world's top stories, the U.S. and its allies brace for more Islamic State attacks in Iraq. The U.S. and Russia push to restore a ceasefire in Syria. Zika outbreaks are expected in a large part of the Americas, and Israel says a Palestinian driver was killed and three Israeli soldiers wounded in the West Bank. Expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is VOA's International Edition. Human Rights Watch is accusing both the Somali government and the militant group Al-Shabaab of using abusive and violent tactics to intimidate journalists. As the world marked Press Freedom Day Tuesday, the rights group is calling on the authorities to act and bring an end to the attacks against journalists in the country. Mohammed Youssef reports.
Human Rights Watch published a report Tuesday titled "Like Fish in Poisonous Water," that documents killings, arbitrary arrests, and threats against journalists since 2014. Letitia Beda, a Human Rights Watch researcher, says Somali journalists face daily threats in doing their work.
Over the last 2 years, we've found that journalists are facing threats, harassment, and also violence from all sides. Traditionally, Al-Shabaab has obviously been one of the most dangerous actors in Somalia for journalists. Now facing threat and manipulation from many different actors, which is making it incredibly difficult for them to report, even on basic news stories.
Since 2014, more than 10 journalists have been killed. Six others survive assassination attempts. One survivor is journalist Abdirizak Ilmi. In October 2014, armed men attacked him outside his house in Mogadishu. A car approached us and it stopped in front of us. They started firing at my friend and me. The first bullet hit me in the hands. When I tried to run, they hit me in the back, my stomach, and around my kidney. I ran towards the house. They continued firing at me. I fainted at the door of the house. Ilmi was hospitalized for 4 months. He says he doesn't know who attacked him, but is certain they attacked because of his work. After much thought, the reason I was attacked, I realized, was because of my profession. I don't believe that there is anything that will make them attack me other than being a journalist. Much of my life and time, I worked in the media. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, most of the journalists killed in Somalia cover politics and war. Last month, the Somali government executed 3 people, including a former journalist, for their alleged involvement in the killing of 6 journalists. Human Rights Watch accuses the government of bringing charges when an act is attributed to Al-Shabaab, but failing to prosecute government officials. The organization also accuses regional authorities of intimidating journalists and closing down media stations that do not comply with unlawful orders. Over the years, many Somali journalists have fled to neighboring countries to escape the threats and intimidation. One of them is Said Hassan, a former reporter now living in Kenya. In Somalia, if you're a journalist, you're a target. Being a target, it makes you worried and fearful all the time. Some time back, they threw a grenade at us, and sometimes they threaten us in our station, he said. Are you going to wait for death? This has forced me and others to flee the country. Earlier this year, President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud signed a controversial media law that gives government officials a wide range of powers to arrest and prosecute journalists for disseminating false information. With Somali elections less than 4 months away, Human Rights Watch called on the government to allow different views and opinions to be aired and to allow safe and open reporting. Mohamed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock, on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Take your peek, watch on television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America. Each Wednesday night, I'll put you in touch with newsmakers and experts as they, you and I, talk about the most important social and political issues in Africa. Shaka Sali saying, I'll be waiting for your call Wednesday night on Straight Talk Africa from The Voice of America.
This is VOA. A U.S.-based rights group says China intends to release the last prisoner serving time in connection with the pro-democracy Tiananmen Square protests of 1989. The San Francisco-based Dui Hua Foundation says 51-year-old Mao Dushun will be released from a Beijing prison in October. The protests ended late during the night of June 3rd, when Chinese tanks and troops put down the rebellion. It is unknown how many people died. John Kam is the executive director of Dui Hua. I asked him how his organization became aware of the intention to release Mao.
From time to time, we get responses from the Chinese government. Other times, we are directed to official sites that are usually not looked at by people, like court websites. And in this case, I can't tell you exactly who it was, but I have now had it verified by two sources.
What was Mr. Mao, what was he convicted of?
He was convicted of arson. So what happened during the May-June protests of 1989, you had basically two types of offenses. One were political offenses. These were counter-revolution. And then the others were offenses of a more general nature, like arson. And that's what Mao Dushun was convicted of. He was apparently accused of throwing debris or a basket onto a burning tank, thereby fanning the flames of the tank.
And then he was apparently sentenced to death.
China has a very unique sentence. It's called death with 2-year reprieve. So you're sentenced to death, but then they watch your behavior while you are actually in prison. And if you do not commit new offenses in the 2 years after the sentence was passed, then the sentence is commuted. Usually it's commuted to life in prison.
Now, a number of prisoners, people convicted, you know, following the 1989 situation there, were released. Why has he been continued to be held in prison?
Well, very good question. Well, first of all, he's just apparently an average worker. He didn't get much international attention. And, of course, the crime he was convicted of was arson. But as your question well puts it, others have been released for violent offenses. Why not him? From what we understand from fellow prisoners who served with him during the 1990s, he refused to admit guilt, and he refused to participate in labor. So he would basically sit in his cell reading newspapers, and he refused to do physical labor. And under the Chinese sentence reduction regulations, unless you acknowledge your guilt and unless you participate in labor, you cannot be eligible for a sentence reduction. So what happened? We don't know, but apparently what the official sources are saying is that in recent years his attitude changed. He did admit guilt. He did. Well, what's striking, of course, is that, you know, he was suffering from physical and mental illness, so he would have been exempt from physical labor, so maybe he didn't actually participate in physical labor.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because of his condition. I mean, when he apparently he's scheduled to be released in October, right. you kind of wonder where will he go? Does he have family members that he's in communication with?
What we have learned from people who served with him all the way up till the late 1990s is that he asked his family not to visit him anymore. I think he felt it was too tough on him. So what I'm hoping is that doesn't mean that the family is estranged. I'm hoping that the family will be able to take him back in and help nurse him back to hopefully a more normal life. Now, in 2013, we reported that an elderly June 4th prisoner had been released. And in that case, the family was simply too poor to take him in, and a neighborhood committee arranged for his lodging and his care.
That's John Kam. He's the executive director of Dui Hua. Turning to our social media segment, International Edition's G. Abby Lee joins me in the studio with what's buzzing online. Hi, G.
Hi, Sarah.
So Wednesday is a special day for Star Wars fans, right?
You bet it is. May 4th is the unofficial Star Wars Day around the world. And the reason why it's May 4th is because the date sounds like May the Force be with you, a phrase used in the film series. Fans celebrate it by dressing as Star Wars characters and hosting movie screenings. For more information on what kind of dessert or costumes to make to celebrate, follow its official Twitter account at, you guessed it, Star Wars.
Great. Changing the gear a bit, what's the social media reaction to Donald Trump's description of his rival Ted Cruz's father?
Sarah, as you can imagine, there were polarizing reactions within the GOP. In an interview with Fox News, Trump argued Cruz's father had ties to the man who killed former President John F. Kennedy.
Tell us about the media coverage of that controversy on social media.
Sure. The two main media outlets that highlighted the claim are, of course, Fox News and the New York Times. Fox News posted Cruz's response on Facebook, writing, "Ted Cruz dismissed the claim this morning and mocked Donald Trump for bringing up tabloid trash." The New York Times posted this, "Donald Trump, who has repeatedly dabbled in conspiracy theories, has accused Cruz's father of associating with Lee Harvey Oswald."
I see. Well, how's the public reacting to these posts?
I found a lot of comments by who I believe are Trump supporters to the Fox News post. They argued if Cruz doesn't want anyone saying anything about his father, he should not stay in the presidential race. Others expressed their concern for the Republican Party. One person wrote, "I didn't know Trump could sink any lower. If he gets the nomination, he's going to lose all the people who supported Cruz. Hello, Madam President Hillary." That's, of course, referring to the Democratic contender Hillary Clinton. Sarah?
Thanks, G, for the wrap-up. That's our own social media guru, G. Abby Lee. If you end up dressing up to celebrate the Star Wars Day, please tweet us pictures and comments to @VOA_IE. You can also tag me and G on the tweets. We are @VOA Williams and @G Abby Lee. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Household pollution kills more than 4 million people each year. Most of these fatalities are in the developing world, many in Africa. Many people die from inhaling smoke from cooking over wood or coal stoves. Solar cookers could be the answer, and a pair of inventors in South Africa have made some improvements to the technology. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Solar power technologist Crosby Menzies moves a big metal frame at the Sunfire Company office in Johannesburg. Attached to it is a panel of 48 mirrors, each about a foot long.
It's 4 square meters of mirrors, 6 to 8 meters in length. It's quite a large cooker. We're very pleased to have built the first one in South Africa.
Menzies' partner, Xander van Manen, tilts the mirrors with a lever until they're bouncing sunlight off another slab of mirrors up to a point under a pan. Within 2 minutes, the sunlight has heated the pan so much that sausages and onions are sizzling away. Menzies says the Sol 4 solar cooker is special because it generates extreme heat very fast.
In 4 minutes, you'll have boiling water. So it's actually comparable to cooking on gas or electricity.
He says using the device is much friendlier than other solar cookers, which force people to stand in the hot sun. The Sol 4 allows users to cook in the shade, on a table, with only the mirrors being positioned in the sun. Menzies says wherever he's demonstrated his solar cookers, people have doubted they work until they see the sun cooking their food and the word is spreading.
We've got literally hundreds of them going out in South Africa. We've got a project coming up in Mali, a project in Ethiopia, and another project in Uganda. I've just come back from Zambia. That the technology really is viable. A lot of people still don't know that it works, and we're working as hard as we can to change that.
He says the major attraction for people is that preparing meals with the sun means they no longer have to collect firewood and buy expensive coal or paraffin to cook with. They are therefore much less likely to get potentially fatal respiratory diseases. The Sol 4 is also able to cook for lots of people at once.
Being that it's so big, it's not the kind of model that you want to move around too often. It's more of a permanent installation, and the places where we see a permanent need for cooking day after day are schools, orphanages, old age homes, or anywhere where there's a need for large-scale cooking, soup kitchens, church groups.
At the moment, says van Manen, the cooker only works if the sun is shining, but he's working on something he calls a magic stone, a slab of compressed salt.
This would be, at the end of the day, our battery, if I can put that in brackets, because what this will do is it will take the stored sunlight and it will store it as heat, and you can then put it in a heat-retaining bag or in heat-retensive space, and then whenever you need it at night, you can take it out and it'll actually radiate heat where you can then cook on or boil water.
So essentially, you'd end up with a mobile hot plate.
Each cooker costs more than $2,000, putting it far out of reach of most Africans. But Menzies says NGOs across the continent are stepping in to finance Sol 4s for vulnerable groups. Darren Taylor for VOA News, Johannesburg.
In show business news, the annual Tony Awards are not handed out until just over a month from now. But one show is already a big winner, as International Edition's Lori London and VOA's Ramon Taylor discuss.
They recognize achievement in live Broadway theater, and today we learned which shows have been nominated for the Tony Awards. And one show in particular, the musical Hamilton, grabbing the most nominations in Broadway history. Quite a feat. Let's talk more about it with VOA's Ramon Taylor in New York. Hi, Ramon.
Hi, Lori.
This is really incredible. Hamilton nominated in virtually every category and breaking a record.
That's right, 16 nominations, breaking every previous record just in that category. 15 was the previous record set by Billy Elliot and the producers, but This is really expected to fare even better during the actual awards ceremony on June 12th. I mean, just an electrifying performance, as you mentioned, nominated in every category: best play, musical, revival of a play, original score, lead actor, pitting two of the greatest actors in modern theater, modern Broadway history together in this year. It's going to be incredible.
What's the appeal? What's the show about?
Well, it's a historical theatrical piece, right? So when you think of U.S. history, when you think of Alexander Hamilton, one of the founding fathers, and the right-hand man to George Washington, you might think dry history, but Manuel Lin-Miranda is a visionary, and he has merged hip-hop culture and history together in this just incredible performance that has the audience on its feet with a musical production that will undoubtedly win at the Tonys this year.
And what other shows got nominated?
Shuffle Along, that received 10 nominations. So by the standards of any other year, that is a great, you know, they have a great chance at this, at achieving something at least. Let's put it that way. That's about a mayoral race in Jimtown, USA, touching on race relations and politics. Very exciting considering that this is an election year. Eclipsed, that is another great performance by Lupita Nyong'o, the Kenyan-Mexican actress who had a breakthrough performance in 12 Years a Slave. She's an incredible actress, and she'll be one to watch out for as well.
Twitter
ready.
And so when
you're
going to
see history in the making this year with Hamilton. 16 nominations, June 12th.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much. We appreciate it. VOA's Ramon Taylor.
Thanks, Lori.
And my thanks to Lori London for that. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. Stay tuned for the latest world news. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Have a great Wednesday.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In Zimbabwe during 2015, the most important human rights problems remain the government's targeting of non-ZANU-PF parties and civil society activists for abduction, arrest, torture, abuse, and harassment. Partisan application of the rule of law by security forces and the judiciary, and restrictions on civil liberties. These are the findings of the U.S. Department of State in its recently released country report on human rights practices around the world. The report notes that Zimbabwe had many other human rights problems. Prison conditions were harsh. The government's expropriation of private property continued. Executive political influence and interference in the judiciary continued, and the government infringed on citizens' privacy rights. The government generally failed to investigate or prosecute state security or ZANU-PF supporters responsible for violence. Authorities restricted freedoms of speech, press, assembly, association, and movement. The government continued to evict citizens, invade farms, private businesses and properties, and demolish informal marketplaces and settlements. The government also arrested, detained, prosecuted, and harassed non-governmental organization members. Government corruption remained widespread, including at the local level. Violence and discrimination against women, child abuse, trafficking of men, women, and children, and discrimination against persons with disabilities, racial and ethnic minorities, lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and intersex persons, and persons with HIV/AIDS were problems in Zimbabwe. The government there interfered with labor-related events. Zimbabwe's government took limited steps to punish security sector officials and ZANU-PF supporters who committed violations, but impunity continued to be a problem. In the arena of human rights, every government has the ability to improve, including the United States, said Secretary of State John Kerry. He noted that the contents of the 2015 report renew our commitment to promoting and protecting universal human rights, to supporting and defending civil society in its peaceful efforts to hold governments accountable, and to working with our partners to advance peace, development, human rights, and democracy.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.